Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, I'll be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby, Joe Antos from the American Enterprise Institute, and former Ambassador and Congressman Dick Sweat. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News. We will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. In an about turn, a stopgap spending bill to avoid a government shutdown at the end of September appears positioned for easy passage. The House passed a continuing resolution, or CR, with bipartisan support, and it seems on track for passage in the Senate later this week. The president apparently plans to sign it as well. The only possible glitch at this point appears to be a push by Senator Rand Paul to reduce spending by 2% via an amendment. The stopgap doesn't fix the issues inherent in this year's appropriations process, but it would give elected leaders more time by extending current funding levels through November 21st. The path forward remains relatively unclear. Partisan tensions resulted in Democrats blocking a package of four spending bills in the Senate that totaled about $985 billion for the upcoming fiscal year. Democrats complained that the labor HHS education bill was being shortchanged for border wall funding. They sought amendments viewed by Republicans as, quote, poison pills, and they opposed the defense bill because it wouldn't stop the president from diverting money from military construction projects to help fund a wall. Although the issue of a border wall and funding has effectively been punted for a few weeks, the Senate plans to vote on a resolution that would terminate the emergency declaration that President Trump issued back in February. The House did something similar in March, but the president vetoed the measure. However, the Senate's vote at that time fell only 8 votes shy of being able to override. This bumpy process and constant need of CRs to avoid shutdowns has caused some elected leaders to call for changes to the budget process and its rules to enable automatic CRs whenever a lapse in appropriations is about to occur. Up next, former Congressman and Ambassador Dick Sweat will join me to discuss political dysfunction and bipartisan solutions. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by former Congressman and Ambassador Dick Sweat. Ambassador Sweat is an architect. He served as ambassador to Denmark from 1998 to 2001, as a Democratic congressman for New Hampshire from 91 to 95. He's a member of the Concord Coalition's State Advisory Board. He also works on a variety of other initiatives. He and I have spoken to captive audiences together. He's offered his expertise and insight on panels during public forums and also on this program. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Ambassador.
Thank you, Chase. Good to be here.
Happy to have you here. And I guess I'll just kick it off by asking this. What is Congress doing? It doesn't seem like they're doing anything together. And since we're talking about political dysfunction and an attempt at bipartisanship today, let's start with that.
Well, it seems like both Congress and the state of New Hampshire are having a hard time in the legislature getting any kind of budgets passed, getting any kind of funding, and they're all operating under continuing resolution. You know, I'm kind of glad I'm not down there, but I'm kind of frustrated that I'm not, because there just doesn't seem to be anybody down there who wants to get anything done.
Well, based on my experience with you, I think you're right. We need you down there because we need more individuals at least willing to reach across the aisle. Not a lot of that is happening right now. We're, you know, the federal budget process is just utter chaos. It's, you know, not working as it should. It hasn't in years, but this year is just par for the course. We've got a budget resolution setting effectively no spending limit, but new high-level watermarks for discretionary spending, and they still can't get bills through the Congress and get it to the president's desk and actually fund the government. Let's back it up a step.
Sure.
Why do you think we are experiencing this level of dysfunction?
Well, I really believe, and one of the reasons I'm here to talk with you is because we're going to travel around the state. I am with former colleagues of mine, Congressman Tim Romer and Congressman Zach Womp, part of the Issue One program, where we are trying to talk about these issues. So in answer to your question, we are at a real important transition period in this country's history. We've been around for 200 plus years. The democracy has survived so far, but we have a real crisis in confidence. There is no confidence in the government, in the local population. We're electing outside players like Donald Trump to president. And now you may support him, you may not, but he is definitely outside the box. And that's because people are frustrated with the same old, same old. And our politicians have forgotten that it's really the people that govern this country. And it's the confidence that they have in their government that makes that government functional. And right now we are operating on continuing resolutions. We're spending up the wazoo. We've got trillions of dollars of debt. We've gone over a $1 trillion deficit. You know, all of these things have to do with the fact that government makes laws and then does not enforce them. And so people do not think that government has their best interests in mind, and they can't predict which way the government's going to go because they're not doing what the government says and is by law supposed to be doing. And that, I think, is the real problem.
You mentioned your work with Issue One. Obviously, you've worked with organizations like the Concord Coalition. You helped start us over 25 years ago. You've done work with No Labels. You're clearly passionate about bipartisan solutions to key issues. So,
can you hear it in my voice?
I can. Okay, I can see it in your face.
I'm bouncing around on the radio station here.
So, going back to Issue One for a second, you mentioned that you're going to be traveling around the state speaking mm-hmm. with former colleagues. What are you hoping to accomplish? There's an event coming up this week. What do you want to see come out of that conversation?
We're trying to help people understand that there are some people who really want to fix this problem. And as I said, the problem has to do with a lack of confidence. Look, you can go back to Washington's farewell address. I talk about that every time I get a chance to. He's got six pillars that he said, if you don't uphold these pillars, we are going to be toast. And the six pillars are, just for the sake of the discussion, you know, he doesn't like political parties. I don't like political parties either. Don't tell that to my Democratic friends, but I'm sorry. That's where I feel.
Especially during a primary.
We need to uphold common values and religious freedom. We have to figure out some set of principles and values that we as a community, as a society, can feel that we are held together by, and we're losing that. We need public education. We need education for all so that everybody can make informed decisions about the kinds of candidates they're electing to office, or whether they're informed enough to run for office themselves. But we need that kind of education. And a lot of people think that, particularly in the public sector, that that's a big problem. We need responsible spending. We already hit that point coming in. There needs to be unity throughout the land, and there certainly isn't right now. There's no bipartisanship, and we need to lessen our entanglements in foreign relationships and issues and problems. So, getting more specifically to what you're talking about and what Issue One is talking about. We want to talk about how do we fix the government? How do we fix these problems? How do we change government so that it's responsive to people again and that it's doing what it's saying it's supposed to be doing? We're trying to bring light into the dark corners. In other words, to address the influx of dark money in elections. We have a lot of problems with that. We want to get rid of the slush funds that the PAC committees have enabled the people to operate with. And we're also trying to fix Congress with bipartisan solutions, not just one side or the other side. That there is a way to work together that I think ultimately we can do this. And we have a caucus in the sitting Congress called the Problem Solvers. They're working together. They're getting boxed about the ears. They're getting abused by the leadership on both sides of the aisle, but they're sticking with it because they could ultimately be the core group that passes legislation one way or another. And if we can support them in that effort, I think it's going to be ultimately good for the country.
So, Ambassador, how did we get here? I mean, you served in the 90s.
I watched it happen over 30 years. And we started, I ran for office because I saw members of Congress willing to denigrate, to tear down the institution in order to take it over. And we won't make any names in this program, but leave any names. But, you know, the fact was that people were standing up and giving special orders and calling out members on the other side and saying, you know, that they were, you know, lousy so-and-sos and such-and-suches. And you know,
That is
no way for us. If you're gonna win an election, why don't you win by being better than your opponent, not by making your opponent worse than you are?
That's a novel idea. Winning because you're better.
I've never really understood why it hasn't been used in the past. But that's that is the first thing. The second I've mentioned is, look at the laws, you know, whether it's immigration or any, the budget or any of the other kind of, rules and regulations that we have in place that how we should operate the government. If we don't follow those rules, then it's kind of a free-for-all. And everybody just thinks they can either come across the borders or they think they can spend money, wantonly without any responsibility. But we have no discipline within the system if we do not discipline ourselves to the rules that we have set. Now, if you don't like the rule, change it. That's fine. That's what legislation is all about. But follow the rules until you have gone through the proper process to change it. And that, I think, would go a great deal down the road towards rebuilding confidence in our government if the people saw that it behaved the way that it was supposed to behave. And I sort of did a little bit of that with a Republican, a good friend of mine, Chris Shays, who we really should have on this show sometime. But
I think we've had him on before, but it's probably high time to bring it back.
That's right. But, we did the Congressional Accountability Act, which was a very simple piece of legislation that took 3.5 years to pass that forces members of Congress to obey the laws that they pass for the rest of the land.
I mean, also a novel idea.
Oh, gosh, no. But anyway, we're into novel ideas. You know, that's what we've got to
go
at.
Right, right. Novel yet obvious. Since you served in Congress, have the rules changed that govern what our elected leaders do and how they do it? Or has it just been we've ignored the rules altogether that even existed decades ago?
I think that they haven't changed as much as we've ignored them more and more. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing is a continued erosion of respect for and adherence to those rules and regulations. And, you know, I'm all for operating outside the box and thinking creatively and doing all this sort of thing. But you can't do that in a society if you want that society to remain cohesive. And as Lincoln said, we must first and foremost be Americans. We must be unified as a country, and we are not right now. And that is a very, very sorry and dangerous place to be.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to former Ambassador Dick Sweat. We're discussing political dysfunction and bipartisan solutions. We haven't quite gotten to the solution side of things yet, but I want to pick up on something you just said, Ambassador. And you mentioned that we've gotten to where we are today in part because not just that maybe the rules have changed a bit, but we've had an erosion of respect for the rules. What do you think has helped accelerate that erosion? Has it been the onslaught of social media, a 24-hour news cycle, a degradation of just pure leadership? How did we get to this point, even how we think as a country?
Sure. Well, I'll go back and repeat what I said before, where I saw members of Congress, people in elected positions who were willing to denigrate and tear down the institutions of our government in order to take them over. So what you do is, yes, you win the position of Speaker of the House or whatever it is, the position you're going after, the presidency for that matter, but you're holding a position that is held in lower regard in the public's eye than it was before. So we're down to now, what, about 10 to 12% favorability for members of Congress?
If that, it depends on the day.
Well, boy, we beat that institution to kingdom come. So now, that's what we're seeing happen all across the board. And it has continued because people continue to do it. And until and unless we stop and we say, wait a minute, we're Americans. We have certain values that we believe in, that we want to uphold, that we think are important not only for us but for the world to see. If we could get back to that place, who knows? We might be able to, you know, straighten out this ship and make it sail straight. I don't know. But, you know, right now it's a ship without a rudder.
So tell me, Ambassador, how do we get back to that point? Is it a policy package to help make it a more, you know, rigid line to walk for members of Congress? Is it an inspirational moment where you're calling upon current and future leaders to be better? What do you think is necessary? What is issue one working on?
So I'll tell you the good news and the bad news. I'll start with the bad news. The bad news is
that
when we get into this position, we always go into like civil wars or world wars or economic disasters like depressions and things like that.
That's a little beyond bad news.
Well, the good news is that those things sort of knock us upside the head with a baseball bat and make us realize, hey, maybe we ought to fight this together. Maybe we ought to join ranks and solve these problems together. The better news is I think we can do this without having to go off a cliff. I think that if we start thinking about what are the qualities of the characters of the people that we're electing to office, what are the things, what are the milestones or the small baby steps that can be taken that, you know, if every month or every quarter we're able to celebrate, we've accomplished something that is moving in the right direction. You know, I don't think having national campaigns with big ideas is actually the way to solve the problem. You know, it may sound good in a soundbite. It may be, you know, a great spot on television. It may be a great issue to debate. But, you know, if you're going to build back confidence in the public, you got to do that step by step. And you've got to show them, you got to tell them what you're going to do, then you do it, and then you do it again quickly. And you do it, and to do it quickly, it has to be small and incremental. And that way, people will begin to trust what you're doing. That's what issue one is trying to do. We're trying to go around the state. We've got Tim Romer coming and Zach Womp, a Democrat and a Republican, coming to New Hampshire, talking to folks at our great universities. We're going to be at Dartmouth and then on Wednesday, and we're going to be in the evening. We're going to be here in Concord at UNH Law, and we're going to be talking about these things, but not as a Democrat or a Republican, but as concerned citizens who want to find a way to get people to work together.
So give our listeners a quick summary. If they can't attend any of these events,
everybody will want to come. It would be so fabulous.
Everyone should go.
Everyone will be there. And so, but we'll rehearse it a little bit just to make sure.
So tell me, in this discussion, you're looking at this from a bipartisan perspective. What do you expect to hear from them beyond sort of the generalities we've been discussing currently? Are they going to propose policy items or process changes? Will they go that far?
Yes. First of all, they're not going to agree on everything. But what they're going to do is they're going to disagree without being disagreeable. And more importantly, they're going to disagree substantively so that everybody who's engaged in that conversation, whether it be at Dartmouth or UNH or you know, wherever it is, they are going to have the ability to think about what the options are and what the decisions that need to be taken in order to make the solutions work should be. So, you know, our hope is that we'll have lots of people at these gatherings, and we're going to talk about, you know, how do you clean up campaign finance? How do you get people to focus on spending the taxpayers' dollar in a way that is both legal, legitimate, and good for the country? We're going to talk about how people in Congress can start working together. What are the issues on health care? What are the issues on infrastructure repair? There are tremendous needs throughout this country, and these issues need to be debated, but they need to be debated constructively in a way that we ultimately get things going and get things done, as opposed to just sort of making a debate for the sake of disagreeing one with another.
And you mentioned that there probably will be some policy suggestions or a conversation that focuses on certain areas that need reform. From your perspective, you don't have to speak on behalf of your former colleagues, but from your perspective, what's the first policy domino that needs to fall to start getting us on the right track? Let's start with maybe election reform or transparency.
Well, election reform, and you know, basically is transparency. You know, is it good for us to have these, you know, secret PACs that no one knows who's giving the money to them that can go around attacking people, you know, without going through the campaign of the opposition? That kind of opacity within the political process is very, very harmful, and I think that needs to be stopped. We can also look at it from the perspective of gerrymandering. You know, do we still want to allow that kind of gerrymandering to take place that has given us about 80% of all of our districts heavily weighted one way or to one party or to the other? Or do we want to go into a non-political process that looks at balances of Republicans and Democratic registration and tries to establish districts where that balance is actually pretty even and people really have to contest for the favor of that voter who is going to go into the ballot box and choose the next election, choose the next congressman or the next senator? So these are the things that, you know, we're very interested in, and we think if we can set that up. Also, let's talk about, we got health care and immigration, big issues. Well, okay, so what are the problems with those two issues, and how do we solve those problems? And are those problems strictly to do with funding, or are they also to do with the trust that the government has, the people have in the government's ability to protect the borders or to provide good health care? And that's something that, you know, we have to look at in terms of comparing the fact that the United States is spending 20% of our GDP on health care and the rest of the world is spending 9%. And right now they are actually coming out higher on the health index than we are. So we're doing things wrong, more expensively and badly, and the rest of the world is kind of passing us by. We once were, you know, one of the, you know, the best health providers in the world, and we are if you have the money or the position or the health insurance. But if you don't have any of those things, then you're out of luck, and I'm sorry.
And I think you mentioned some really, really, really big topics in immigration and health care that probably require several shows to discuss.
But, you know, it's interesting, Chase, you know, several years ago, we wouldn't dare talk about any of these things.
Well, I guess we've made progress.
Well, and I would, you know, and look, I can tip my hat to Donald Trump as the outlier that he is, that he's a disruptor. He has come in and everything is in play. Now we got to get people in office who are willing to work together to resolve what's out of balance and to put it back into balance. And by gosh, don't do it the way it was before Trump was elected, because we weren't in the right place then and people knew it. So now we can get those things back into balance with the right people. And it's going to be a very interesting election to see who the public picks to do that.
I agree. It's an interesting time for policymakers. It's a difficult time. I think the partisanship and the unwillingness to work together is a difficult hurdle to get over. So I hope that what issue one is focused on, what groups like No Labels and the Concord Coalition are focused on, I hope there's success there, and I hope voters are listening. And as always, I appreciate you taking the time, Ambassador, to share your insights and expertise. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and former Ambassador Dick Sweat discuss political dysfunction and bipartisan solutions. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Joe Antos from the American Enterprise Institute will join me to discuss healthcare reform. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Wilson H. Taylor, resident scholar in healthcare and retirement policy at the American Enterprise Institute, or AEI, Joe Antos. Bob is a regular contributor on the show. You're quite familiar with him. Joe has been on before, but not for a while. He focuses his work on the economics of health policy, including Medicare, single-payer health insurance proposals, the uninsured, the Affordable Care Act, and the overall reform of the healthcare system. He also teaches at George Washington University and is the vice chair of the Maryland Health Services Cost Review Commission, where he's serving a third term as a commissioner. He has also worked at the CBO, DHHS, OMB, and the President's Council of Economic Advisors. He's regularly published and engages in frequent media interviews. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Bob and Joe.
Thanks, Chase.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Chase.
Well, it's a pleasure having you both on the show, and I think we're going to talk about a rather important and intricate topic, and that is healthcare. AEI and Brookings just issued a report. In fact, you just wrapped up a panel discussion on it. Joe, you co-authored this report with the late Alice Rivlin, a dear friend and colleague, and she's certainly sorely missed, leaves big shoes to fill in the policy world. And besides the namesake of the report, which is a new vision for health reform, what is the report? What's it meant to do? Why write it?
So, you know, the title is a little immodest, frankly. It's the way I think of this report is that it is a basic primer on the problems that we have that are driving up healthcare costs, but not driving up value, and also not just driving up healthcare costs in general, but also driving up governmental costs, which are contributing greatly to our overall national fiscal problems, driving up the national debt. And just in general, we're devoting huge amounts of resources, both publicly and privately, to a system that really isn't sustainable in the long run. So we've got to get a handle on that, and that's what this report really is about.
And you mentioned a few big areas that healthcare impacts. You know, where are we right now in our healthcare system? What are some of the trends that we're experiencing?
So here's some numbers that won't make anybody happy. First of all, the national debt. We're at $22.6 trillion for the national debt. And it's rising every day. So we're on an uphill climb there. Healthcare is the biggest contributor. It is the single biggest spending item in the federal budget. I have a figure for this. Right now, we're spending something like $1.25 trillion on Medicare, Medicaid, health insurance subsidies from the Affordable Care Act and the Children's Health Insurance Program. And that's just the federal dollars. That's the disturbing part. That's just federal money. You know, the states are kicking in an enormous amount of money for Medicaid. And, of course, all of us are paying taxes. They're supporting these programs. And we're also buying our own health insurance and paying that way as well. So the health sector is a huge sector. It accounts for 18% of GDP. It may be the single largest, I think it's probably the single largest sector of the economy. I think defense is definitely below this. And I, when I think about things, manufacturing is probably higher. But if you think about specific industries within manufacturing, I think, which is probably the more appropriate way to
and
do
it. It's growing.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's growing as a share.
Growing as a share. That's right. So this is a huge problem for us. Yes, there is more employment in the health sector than ever before, but of course the question is, are we getting value for those dollars? And just because we're adding more people to process claims, that really isn't necessarily improving our lives.
And Joe, you mentioned a key word there, and I think that is value. And a couple questions I have relative to what you just said and tying it into overall value. But how does healthcare impact the federal budget in that? Is it really a bad thing that we spend over $1 trillion on healthcare from the federal government perspective? Is that bad, and why?
Well, I think it's really a question of priorities. We have a lot of federal priorities beyond healthcare, and so to the extent that federal health spending is growing largely unconstrained as it has been for decades, that means that we'll have less money to spend on other things that everybody cares about. We care about education. We care about the infrastructure. I don't want to be on that bridge when it collapses. We do care about national defense. We can all have different views about where we want to put our money, but there's no question that everyone would agree that the federal government should be using our money wisely in many, many areas, not just healthcare. Healthcare is important, but it's not the only thing. And as I say, it's growing so rapidly that it is beginning to crowd out other important priorities.
I just think also when you ask that question, it's important to think that, well, you know, healthcare is going to be more expensive because there are more beneficiaries, people are older and living longer. The more important question, which Joe Gutt is alluding to earlier, is the value, is, you know, the extent to which healthcare costs rise faster than the economy on a per-person basis. So is there a way that we can deliver healthcare more efficiently, still being effective, but being more efficient about how healthcare is delivered? And that's one of the good things about this paper, is just looking at this problem, not just from a green eye shade point of view of, oh, well, we just need to cut benefits or raise taxes to pay for all this. It's really looking at strategies for controlling healthcare costs through the system, not just for the federal budget, but that would help state and local governments and the private sector as well.
Let me just add one more thing on that, which is a reasonable focus on the federal role in this is that, of course, the federal government finances the Medicare program. The Medicare program is the largest single financier of health care in this country, but also it has regulatory powers.
It's a leader.
It's a leader, and oftentimes in a negative sense. So basically, when Medicare sets a policy or establishes an approach to something, people often say trickle through the rest of the health sector. It's more like a flood.
I have a flood of questions that would come on the heels of everything that you just said, and I do want to get into what the report or the plan is meant to address, maybe even some of the more granular issues. But before we do, I had a couple more high-level questions. One is, why does it matter that healthcare spending might be crowding out other areas of spending? Because, you know, from the average person's perspective, we have trillion-dollar deficits, so why couldn't we just prioritize everything? And then I guess the second follow-on question is, what's driving this cost growth?
So the crowding out is an interesting question. Of course, sort of by definition, the national debt is crowding out our overall ability to do anything. So when I think about crowding out, I'm really mostly worried about that. The rest of it is really how do you allocate the money that you have? And as I say, people can have different opinions about how important it is for me not to be killed driving down the road versus not to die from not being treated from a disease. The one theme there, by the way, you may have noticed is
you
death.
Don't want to
yeah,
death,
yeah. Exactly.
That makes sense. But let me chime in on that too, because what we haven't mentioned is that this paper is part of a Concord Coalition project on a fiscally responsible path to economic growth, emphasizing both fiscal responsibility and economic growth. And so you need to be able to, if we're going to be able to grow the economy, Joe was talking about crowding out and the deficit, and one of the issues there with the economy is that if the federal government is running these enormous budget deficits, it does crowd out or kind of absorbs the savings that could be used otherwise for private sector investments that would help grow the economy. And so if you say, well, that's happening because of these big budget deficits, why are the big budget deficits happening? Well, the biggest spending increase is on healthcare. So, you know, the part that's growing, it's already big. It's already the biggest part of the federal budget, and it's growing the fastest. So I think that if you're going to look at a policy agenda that's both fiscally responsible and pro-growth, that route at some point has to go through healthcare reform.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Joe Antos from AEI. We're discussing healthcare reform and the paper recently published by AEI and Brookings, worked on by Joe and the late Alice Rivlin. And before we jump into the report, I do want to follow up on my other question, which was, What's driving this cost growth? What's driving the acceleration or I guess the takeover of spending on health care relative to other areas of spending or priorities we might need to have?
So there are a couple of areas. Everyone is familiar with the aging of the population. We're all getting older. It is kind of interesting when you think about the Medicare program that thanks to a whole bunch of things, the baby boom generation is undoubtedly the healthiest generation to reach 65 and enter the Medicare program. But what that means is that we're going to live longer, and it's going to take us a bit longer to get to that stage where we're really spending money because we have very serious health problems, as you know, en masse. Obviously, there are obviously baby boomers who have serious illnesses now, but I'm speaking out of this generally in population terms. But when we finally get there, it's going to be, again, one of these floods. There are so many of us. I'm a baby boomer. I think
I am.
Bob is too, and you may well be as well.
I definitely am
not.
And
if you're not, you're a millennial. Well, in that case, thank you for paying your taxes.
And
you're welcome. but so aging of the society is a part of it. That's a good thing. But eventually, we get into a stage where we're going to have a very, very needy health needy population in terms of needing services, and we're not good at saying no, and we're not good at letting people suffer. That's a good thing about this country, but it puts a huge burden on everybody, especially the younger people who are going to be paying the taxes. That's one factor. Another factor is prices. This was brought up at our event today, and it's true that we pay higher prices for darn near everything in healthcare than any other country in the world. Now, to some extent, that's also true for cell phones. That's also true for everything we buy. But there is a real disparity there that is not explained by we're not getting more services. We're not necessarily, we're getting some better services. I mean, if I had a very serious illness that required high-tech medicine, I want to be in this country. I don't want to be anywhere else. But in terms of basic medical care that people need on a regular basis for ordinary conditions, we don't do a very good job of that. We also tend to spend up where a simple test will do a complicated test. Where no test is needed, we'll do a test. Why? Because we're in a fee-for-service health sector, and what that means is that the provider doesn't get paid unless they provide a service, and the more services they provide and the more expensive the service, the more they get paid. So the incentives are all wrong that way, and then on the consumer side, the incentives are all wrong there too, because we generally have, most people have good coverage, they have relatively low cost sharing. I know that people complain about this, but compared to the total cost of the service, we're not aware of the total cost, and so there's less of a personal feeling that if I go along with everything this doctor tells me to do, that this might be very expensive to me, so we don't have those conversations about that we really need between the doctor and the physician. About what should we be doing here? Is there a better way that will deal with my health condition but will not be so expensive? I think that conversation doesn't happen on a regular basis.
No, it doesn't function like a lot of normal markets do. So the question is, you know, how can you take some of those market forces and make it applicable to the healthcare system? Because it is a different thing than buying a car, if you're thinking about treating a disease or something like that, but we should bring more market forces to bear. But as Joe was saying, in order to do that, you really need to have better transparency of costs and outcomes. So you know you can't have consumers involved in consumer choice if you don't know what the costs are. It, yeah. it, 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 So One of the issues addressed in this paper is just looking at those issues and not looking at anything as a magic bullet, but saying, okay, here are some ways in which attempts have been made to bring market forces to the healthcare system. Here are the challenges for doing that. A lot of us don't want to shop for healthcare. It's just easy to go to the doctor, and if the doctor says you need an MRI, go to the hospital right here that I'm associated with. And in fact, this happened to me a couple of months ago. And you don't sit there. You just instinctively, you don't say, well, wait a minute. Before I have this MRI, I am going to go home and check online. I'm going to find the cheapest MRI I can possibly get. The doctor says, I think you should go over to the emergency room there and that's what you do because you don't really think about it.
Let's take a closer look at this paper, Bob and Joe, because unfortunately, much is the case when we have great conversation on the show, we're running short on time. So in these final minutes, Joe, can you give us a broad description or summary of the strategies and tools that you and Alice Rivlin worked on and laid out in this paper and why you think it's a good approach moving forward?
Okay, absolutely. I'll be repeating a little here, but these, we have four main tools. They're all very important. And honestly, people have been talking about these exact same tools for a long, long time. So as Bob said, first of all, improve the information available, not just to the patient, but also to the doctor about prices, quality of care, and patient outcomes. And that also applies to insurance. You have to know what kind of insurance you're buying, and you want to know what's covered, and you want to know what it's going to cost you, and you want to know what the options are. So you need that. We need to know about insurance, and you need to know about treatment, and you need to know about who the provider is and what their capabilities are and what the cost is. Second, again, Bob said this, we have to shift away from fee-for-service payment, and we have to get patients more involved in the joint decision-making that should go on between the doctor, the insurance company, because the insurance company is involved, and the patient. We need all three of them to be involved in this. So moving away from fee-for-service and making everybody in the system, not just the patient, but also the doctor, more aware that there are opportunities to reduce unnecessary cost and to improve outcomes. That's critical. Third, we need to remove barriers to competition. And we have barriers all over the place. There are barriers to competition among insurers, among healthcare providers. In most cities in this country, there are major health systems that basically control all of healthcare. There's very little effective competition. And if there's competition, it's more competition to move up the use of services rather than move down the cost of care. And then the last one, which is also very important, and this reflects the fact that Alice and I try to be realistic about things. Not everything can be solved by market forces. Sometimes you need appropriate regulation, and sometimes you need the government to intervene. And there are markets where things just don't work very well. Clearly, even this question of market consolidation, where you have big health systems controlling all the healthcare in a city, in an urban area. There's a place for looking at whether that next merger is really appropriate and is really going to improve the cost of care, improve the value of the services, or whether it's just a money grab. So those are our four strategies. There are many, many specific policies that would support those strategies, but that was basically our orientation. What we didn't want to do was upend the current system, because that will eventually lead you to real problems, going from what we have now to something totally different is not popular with the public, and opens up all sorts of questions that basically boil down to, how do you do that anyway? We don't know.
And obviously, we could and probably should go into more detail, so I'm going to encourage our listeners to, A, read the report, A New Vision for Health Reform by AEI and Brookings, and B, listen to the panel discussion that Joe was just on when it's made available. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Wilson H. Taylor, Resident Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at AEI, Joe Antos. We discussed healthcare reform and the paper they recently published on ways to address the system moving forward. Thanks for joining the show, Bob and Joe.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.